From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. American troops have begun to land in Somalia to protect the delivery of relief supplies. On today's Fresh Air, what it's like to do relief work in Somalia. We'll talk with Ann Stingle of the American Red Cross. She was in Somalia last spring and returns there tomorrow. Also, we discuss the U.S. intervention with the director of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson. TransAfrica is the Black American lobby for Africa and the Caribbean. And we look at the changing role of the U.S. military with Michael Clare, professor of peace studies and world security at Hampshire College. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. American troops have begun landing in Somalia, and officials in the capital are warning armed men to stay away from the city's air and seaports where hundreds of Marines will be coming ashore. NPR's Deborah Wong is in Mogadishu, and she describes the flurry of activity that led up to tonight's landing. From Mogadishu, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
A delegation of American officials led by former U.S. Ambassador to Somalia, Robert Oakley, held meetings with the leaders of Somalia's two main warring factions who promised their full cooperation. The Somali leaders said they would broadcast warnings to their armed men to stay away from the city's port and airstrip. Oakley told reporters he does not expect an organized opposition to the deployment. However, he said that factional leaders acknowledged that they cannot control all of the gunmen now running loose in the capital. It's not clear how quickly the Americans will move from their landing points into the city itself. Oakley said that after securing Mogadishu, the next phase of the operation will be to step up the movement of relief supplies into the interior of the country. I'm Deborah Wong in Mogadishu.
El Salvador's army said today that it's dissolving its controversial Atlacatl battalion as part of its efforts to end the country's 12-year civil war. The Atlacatl battalion was praised by Salvador's army chiefs and U.S. military advisors as Salvador's best defense against leftist guerrillas. Human rights groups have accused the battalion of massive atrocities, including the murders of six Jesuit priests in 1989 and the massacre of as many as 1,000 civilians in 1981. The battalion's formal dissolution was carried out in accordance with the UN-brokered peace accords. In the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, Serbian tanks have closed roads leading to the airport. UN officials fear the move is part of a Serbian attempt to cut off Sarajevo for the winter and starve its civilians into submission. The BBC's Malcolm Brabant reports.
The early morning offensive took the UN by surprise and exposed their impotence. All appeals to the Serbs to withdraw were ignored. Four tanks and a multi-barreled rocket launcher are reported to have used the road to pummel the frontline suburb of Dobrinja relentlessly. Civilians contacted there said it was one of the worst bombardments of the war. The Serbs hit the makeshift hospital where over 40 patients were being treated. Down in the bunker, wearing his protective helmet, the UN's commander in Sarajevo, Egyptian General Ali Abdel Razak, insisted that the road should be kept open and he appealed for both sides to stop fighting. But as yet, the Serbs show no sign of moving. They've flagrantly broken the airport agreement, which guarantees the UN the right of free access. There is one alternative route, but it crosses several front lines and is considered unsafe.
Malcolm Brabant in Sarajevo. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 3,222. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. Safety officials in Norton, Virginia, have suspended part of the search for eight men missing after an explosion in a coal mine. The underground search was called off after rescue crews detected smoke, heat, and methane gas near the site of yesterday's explosion. The crews had gotten to within 300 feet of where the miners were thought to be, about a mile inside the mine. Workers have started drilling a ventilation hole into the area where the men are believed to be. They said they plan to lower a camera to search for signs of life. The National Glass Ceiling Commission heard testimony from women and minorities in Kansas City, Kansas today. The Civil Rights Act of 1991 set up the commission to study artificial barriers to job advancement. Mary Jo Draper of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports.
The term glass ceiling has been used to describe the obstacles women and minorities face in reaching top management positions. A retired scientist, Dr. T.C. Peng, told the commission he felt he faced discrimination in his 23-year career in the aerospace industry. For instance, Peng says his supervisor required him to take remedial English courses, even though he'd published numerous technical papers.
The long delay in my career promotion, probably 10 years overdue, is the result of deep-seated prejudice against Chinese and Chinese Americans. And the poor English writing was just an excuse.
Other speakers told the commission that women and minorities have been forced to start their own businesses because they can't get ahead in corporate America. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Jo Draper in Kansas City.
A top Federal Reserve official warned bankers today that if they don't eliminate racism from mortgage lending, government regulation will do it for them. Federal Reserve Governor Lawrence Lindsay said that recent studies show clear evidence of discrimination in mortgage lending. He said that whites were more than twice as likely as blacks earning the same income to get an approved mortgage. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Anne Stingle, leaves for Somalia tomorrow. Her first trip there was last spring. Stingle is a spokesperson for the American Red Cross. The International Committee of the Red Cross is the lead relief agency in Somalia. The Somalian relief effort is the largest Red Cross mission since World War II. This year, the Red Cross has delivered 146,000 metric tons of food to Somalia. The Red Cross has persisted in spite of anarchy and armed bandits. 8 Red Cross workers have lost their lives in the current unrest. I asked Stingle what she hopes will change for relief workers in Somalia when the U.S. troops get to work. They've already started to arrive.
Now, I'm speaking personally, not organizationally. Mostly for the workers themselves, for them to be able to carry out their work in a secure environment, for them to be able to carry out the mission that they were given when they went there. All of them went there to help stop the famine, to help stop the hunger, to put an end to children dying from a lack of food. And for the worker, I think that's what they all hope for. If I could speak for them, I think they would say that finally to be able to be successful in this operation, to stop the children from dying, to let the families return to their farms and to plant their seeds again and to herd their cattle, to return to their life.
Someone from Save the Children was just quoted in Time magazine as saying this: "We would like someone to explain what is going to happen with this mission because we're going to be in the middle of it." Do you have similar fears of that people will be caught in the middle and not really informed enough about what's happening?
Well, workers are rather isolated out in some of those villages, and that's why I think the relief agencies have them on alert. They are isolated, but I think that the military has been in discussion with, if I'm not mistaken, that they've been in discussion with the relief organizations. I guess it raises the question as what is the alternative. It was clearly not working before. The food was not getting through. People were dying. Relief workers were still in jeopardy. What was going on before was unacceptable.
Is the Red Cross on alert?
They have put their staff on alert for, there is an evacuation plan should the need arise.
How are you preparing for your trip to Somalia tomorrow?
In what way? In terms of psychologically?
Psychologically and in terms of what you're going to need to have with you.
I'm packing for heat. I know that's going to be very hot. Having been there in April and May, I'm fairly clear on what is required, that kind of thing. Also, I think psychologically I am better prepared than I was in April and May. I've been with the Red Cross since 66, and I've been in various conflict situations, and I was in the 84-85 drought. But this one, I was very naive in thinking I was prepared for what I was about to see. And when I got there, I was just overwhelmed by the enormity of the human suffering, by the level of human misery that was present in Somalia. I had never seen anything like it in my life, and hope never to again. So at least this time, I am a little more prepared for that kind of impact than I was before. I was caught a little off guard.
Can you share with us something that you witnessed during that trip in April and May that you were so unprepared for?
I think, first of all, it was the enormity. It wasn't just an isolated incident here or there. It was what I would notice as an individual and looking at other individuals. I would see that it was repeated everywhere. To watch a mother try to nurse a child that is dying in her arms of starvation, and she's just instinctively trying to nurse it and feed it, and she is so malnourished, she has nothing left to give it. And to see the child clutch at her, and literally claw at her, because it knows, again, instinctively, that this is where it gets its nourishment and its life. And again, nothing. And that poor mother, I mean, I'm a mother, and how must that feel? I kept looking at this, and as I said, it didn't happen just once or twice. It was again and again and again. And I was thinking, that must be for a mother. That must be hell. The definition of hell, not to be able to give your child the nourishment that it needs to sustain life. You also see, going to the hospitals, and you see children that have been victims of just this random gunfire that goes on, and the hospital has brought them back and has given them, operated on them, fed them, and eventually they will leave. Then what happens to them? What are they released to in that kind of environment? In Belitwane, I also saw mothers rubbing their children with animal blood because they believed it would help them. It was a place where I simply walked into an office and cried. It was a very emotional experience.
You know, everyone has been so moved just seeing pictures of what's happening in Somalia, and you wonder, who are these bandits who are allowing their own people to starve?
Yeah, I think it's a number simplification, but I think it has a lot of relevance here. If you're familiar with Golding's Lord of the Flies, it's very much like that. When you take away the social structure that a human being is used to, and in the case of Lord of the Flies, it was boys from a British boys' school. In Somalia, it is Somalis. But when you take away social structure and certain ethics and moral teachings, when you remove them from that environment, or remove those things from the environment that the people are in, which is the case in Somalia, when all of that is gone, there are some people who rise to the challenge and are the best that they can be, and there are others who sink to very animal behavior. And to me, Somalia is an absolute living Lord of the Flies. Lord of the Flies was very prophetic in that way. Now, I don't want anyone to lose sight of the fact that there are an awful lot of Somalis who are trying to be a force for good in their country. The ICRC is working with 1,600 members of the Somali Red Crescent. There are women's groups and voluntary organizations in the villages and in the towns. UNICEF, Save the Children, the Red Cross, they all work with them in helping with the distribution. There are a lot of people, and so it's not always just a case, well, there are the bandits and the starving. There are people that really want to be a force for change, and I think they need to be empowered by that. or empowered in doing that, certainly.
My guest is Anne Stingel, spokesperson for the American Red Cross. She leaves for Somalia tomorrow. She was last there in the spring. My guest will be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anne Stingel of the Red Cross. What have Red Cross workers faced in Somalia that's different from any other Red Cross experience?
I think it's a combination of psychological factors. I think this is one of the more difficult psychological assignments or psychological challenges for a relief worker. And I wouldn't want to speak for other agencies, but my guess is they might agree with me. You have, first of all, a relief worker faced with people in this condition. And we've all seen the images. And they're all around you. And you see them dying. You see the bodies collected. You see the burial mounds. You're faced with just the sheer enormity of suffering. Then you're faced with the fact that you can only do so much. You can work from sun up to sundown. You can lift grain. You can do all of those things. And there are still people dying. And sometimes food won't get through because a thug has looted the warehouse. And you know that because of that, more people are going to die. And then you overlay on top of that the personal security risk that is in place for relief workers there because they are connected with food. So it is a very difficult situation in terms of psychological effects. And also that in other conflicts, and I'm speaking for the ICRC who is engaged in so many conflicts around the world, in many of them, certainly with the exception of Bosnia, but with many of them, there are sides, particular sides. There are particular front lines. Yes, there's sporadic fighting here and there, and it may be somewhat scattered, but it seems to have some methodology to it or some sense of organization, as crazy as that seems with conflict. But in Somalia, it's anarchy. You're surrounded by unpredictable people with guns, children with guns, children with grenade launchers, and they're riding around on these vehicles, and it's all around you. The rifle fire is constant. If you're in a feeding center, constant. In fact, I was in a Save the Children center, and there was incoming fire. So it's the volatility and the unpredictability of it that makes it difficult as well.
Did you have any direct encounters with any of the bandits, any of the teenagers who ride around on those trucks with guns?
Did I have? I stayed very, very clear of them, quite. They're very unpredictable, and you're not encouraged to deal directly with them in most cases. I know I had a video camera with me, and there was one blocking the street and turning around, and it was extremely heavily armed. And I wanted to tape it, and they told me not to. I mean, not to provoke these people at all. They really do terrorize the streets. They rule the streets. And the security, and once you decide, okay, I'm going in, you can't sit around and worry about it, but you're aware of it. You're constantly aware of it.
What kind of protection do you have at the Red Cross kitchens and the Red Cross camps?
There are security teams that the Klan elders, the Red Cross works with the Klan elders in organizing the kitchens, and the Klan elders select the manpower. I mean, the Red Cross simply doesn't have enough people to be able to carry out every single thing in a relief operation of this magnitude. So they work with the Klan elders. They select people to help distribute the food. They may turn it over to, like I said, one of the voluntary groups, one of the women's groups. They also then select out the security team.
What did you eat when you were in Somalia in April and May? And was it a crisis for you to eat knowing that other people were starving?
That does go through your mind, absolutely. It's one of those things that you have to decide that, you know, for people in a relief agency, if you starve to death, you aren't going to help anyone. So it's something you do have to work through. But you're certainly conscious of it as you eat. That while you're there, someone else has nothing, and it adds to the psychological difficulty, quite frankly. It also makes it, for me, I noticed it when I came home and went to a grocery store again. I mean, I was reminded of how much we have to go. I'm just kind of talking about things that hit me when I came back, and go into a restaurant and you see these huge portions and people aren't even able to finish them. And my own children, who, you know, they hate to see me come back from these things because I just am fanatic about wasting food, and they have to live with that for a while.
Is there clean water to cook with in Somalia?
No, the water is not safe. The water that is boiled, you know, in cooking for the rice and so forth, it is boiled so that that's somewhat clean. But the relief agencies all bring in bottled water for their staff.
Do the relief workers eat the same food as they give to the Somalians?
No, from most of the agencies there, the food is flown in for them, and I'm sure it runs the same risks as the other food, but they try to do it with an eye to making it as much like home or as they can, with an eye to how much stress can you put on a relief worker.
Do the relief workers eat their food in the presence of Somalians who are starving, or do they have a separate?
Never. No, you never eat in front of the people. I mean, even if you're walking around with, and you've gone all day and you haven't eaten and you have crackers in your pocket, no, you never do that.
So where do they eat?
In their homes. They all have houses or little apartment kind of dwellings, and they eat in the privacy of their home.
What protection do you have against the diseases that you'll be exposed to?
A lot of shots before you leave. I just finished having mine yesterday. And malaria pills, those kinds of things. I mean, you protect yourself as well as you can and then just hope for the best. Of course, there are some things you cannot be inoculated for, and tuberculosis is so rampant there. Also, cholera, the immunization for cholera is not always effective, so they recommend against getting immunized for it. It's just something you take precautions, you do what you can, and then you have to not worry about it. And quite frankly, when you see what condition the people are in, you don't worry about yourself anymore. You really don't. And that's not an attempt to sound noble. You're so struck with how much worse it is for those people that must live there that it very quickly puts things in perspective.
You've described incredible psychological pressures that face relief workers in Somalia. Do relief workers ever kind of crack up, break down?
heard of it happening. I'm sure it happens. In any situation like that. But I know that there, when I was there, there was a doctor that, as he went to the different feeding centers, he was also alert to signs that the difficulty of the situation might be getting to some of the workers, and then they're withdrawn, and in fact, they're withdrawn periodically just into Kenya so that they can relax and have a hot shower and then go back. So they try, they try to be aware of the stress and the difficulty that the assignment places on the workers.
Tomorrow you leave for Somalia. Did you volunteer to go to Somalia?
Oh, yes. And I've wanted to go back since I was there before.
Why do you want to go back? I know it was a very upsetting experience for you.
Yes, because once you see that kind of human need, you really want to do whatever you can do to help. It's a commitment I made in the middle of the feeding centers. Or in the displaced persons camps. Every instinct in my body said, feed these people. And at the time I was in Mogadishu, there hadn't been no food coming in since November, and this was in May. And in the end, just all I could do was walk out of the camp. And I made a commitment to myself and to those people that I would do everything I could to raise awareness and to help bring their story and make it known. And this is just an ongoing part of that.
How long will you be in Somalia?
It's not clear right now, at least 2 weeks, if not more.
How does your family feel about you going?
Well, they've long ago given up changing my mind about anything like this. I think they're a little concerned. In fact, my husband, for the first time ever last night, expressed concern. He usually just looks at me patiently. I'm not as concerned as I was, I think, the first time. I'm much more, I'm much more aware of the reality of it and can deal with it.
Well, I want to wish you good luck with your trip to Somalia, and I'll let you prepare for it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Anne Stingle is spokesperson for the American Red Cross. She leaves for Somalia tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The United States has sent troops to help solve Somalia's immediate crisis, mass starvation. What can we do to solve the underlying problem, political anarchy? We'll talk with Randall Robinson, executive director of Trans Africa, the Black American lobby for Africa and the Caribbean. And we'll call Michael Clare, a professor of peace and world security studies. Clare says chaos in Somalia is an example of the new kind of enemy we face in the post-Cold War era. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The first American troops moved ashore in Somalia several hours ago as a group of reporters and camera personnel watched their landing. These U.S. Marines are the first of some 1,800 on board three U.S. ships offshore. Well before the U.S. arrival, a number of armed Klansmen left the airport area. The seizure of the airport and harbor area in Somalia is the first step in a plan to take control of vital gateways for international aid and get food and medicine to people now facing starvation. President-elect Bill Clinton is not as optimistic as some about the state of the U.S. economy. Despite a drop in unemployment and other favorable economic indicators, Clinton said today that there is no clear evidence that the current recession is over. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bill Clinton brought a message of caution to Washington, D.C. this trip. "We're nowhere near knowing the recession is over," he told reporters today after meeting with congressional leaders and newly elected members.
"There is a lot of talk in the atmosphere today of people saying, well, you know, maybe you don't need to do anything about this economy because the unemployment rate's going down and the housing starts are up and everything's just hunky-dory."
Clinton said he's still committed to fixing fundamental economic problems that he says have been 20 years in the making. Democrats pledged cooperation to enact Clinton's legislative agenda today. The president-elect, however, acknowledged that his attention may be diverted soon to pressing foreign policy problems such as Somalia. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Associated Press is quoting sources as saying that Bill Clinton has decided on House Budget Committee Chairman Leon Panetta to become his budget director, with other top economic jobs going to banker Robert Rubin and economist Lawrence Summers. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports that Clinton is also considering top cabinet positions.
The betting is, as one Clinton aide put it, that the next attorney general will wear a skirt. Among the women said to be on Mr. Clinton's short list are two federal appeals court judges, a state court judge, and a prominent Washington attorney. The federal judges are Patricia Wald in Washington, D.C., and Amaya Kearse in New York, both Carter appointees. Wald, 64, is said to have serious reservations about leaving the bench. Kearse has two special attributes. She's Black and Republican. The state judge is Judith Kaye, who currently serves on New York State's highest court and is being mentioned as a possible chief justice for the state. The Washington lawyer is Brooksley Bourne, who was the first woman to serve as chair of the American Bar Association's important screening committee for federal judgeships. Both Bourne and Kaye have worked closely with Hillary Clinton on issues affecting women and the law. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 15 points to close at 3,322.18 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. 1 week after a huge oil spill off the coast of northern Spain, residents nearby are trying to determine just how much damage has occurred to the region's fishing industry. A Greek tanker ran aground last week during high winds and seas, spilling millions of gallons of crude oil. Divers have not been able to get to the ship's hull to find out how much of its 24 million gallons of crude oil escaped. Officials say some 800 fishermen will be off work at least through the middle of the month, the last day of a fishing ban in affected areas. The Food and Drug Administration has announced it is adopting new rules intended to shorten the approval time for drugs to treat diseases like AIDS, cancer, and Alzheimer's. NPR's Joe Palca has a report.
The rule change follows years of pressure from AIDS activists who said FDA took too long to approve new drugs for life-threatening diseases. The problem is that it can take years to prove an experimental drug is actually preventing deaths. The FDA will now approve drugs based on preliminary signs that the drug is working. For example, approving an AIDS drug that helps restore a patient's white blood cells but hasn't been definitively shown to prolong life. The new rules also require more post-approval monitoring and streamlined procedures for removing drugs from the market if they aren't working. Critics warn that these preliminary signs can be misleading. They also question whether FDA can force companies to withdraw drugs. The new rules will become effective in the next few days. I'm Joe Palca in Washington.
According to a new survey, the nation's purchasing managers expect the country's economy to expand next year, but only by a modest amount. The National Association of Purchasing Management says, however, that its members are more optimistic about next year's economic conditions than they were about this year's. At the same time, job cuts are not believed over. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Trans Africa is the Black American lobby for Africa and the Caribbean. Last August, the executive director, Randall Robinson, criticized the Bush administration for its callous reaction to the mass starvation in Somalia. Earlier today, we called Robinson to get his reaction to the president's decision to send American troops there. Robinson is probably best known in America for leading the movement to boycott South Africa. Earlier today, TransAfrica held a press conference in which they called for a peace conference between Somalian clan elders, local leaders, militia leaders, and members of the UN Security Council in order to rebuild civil society there. I asked Robinson if he supports the deployment of American troops.
Well, I think the intervention is an appropriate response to the problem. I wish it were not necessary, but in fact it is. Some 300,000 people have already starved to death, and perhaps thousands are dying daily because people who need food can't get it because the country is an armed camp with no central police authority at all. What has happened is that a country historically, traditionally pastoral, for centuries, during the Cold War, was turned into an arsenal when first the Soviets poured in arms, and then from 77 through 1989, the U.S. contributed in arms and foreign assistance $884 million to the 21-year dictatorship of Siad Barre. And when that fell apart, of course, the country fell into to anarchy with all of these arms there. Now you have kids who formerly led pastoral lives now riding around on the backs of trucks with AK-47s.
Do you think because some of those arms are arms that America shipped to Somalia during the Cold War that we have a special responsibility?
Oh, absolutely. There are other Somalias in Africa. The Cold War for these countries is far from over. It's unfortunate that Africa's end to colonialism occurred in the middle of the Cold War, and so that many of these countries never had a chance to develop stable political systems in the middle of the Cold War, because we imposed, purchased leadership in countries like Sudan, Liberia, Kenya, Zaire. All of these countries have the potential of developing into Somalias because of what we did to them with the infusion of arms and support for bad leadership and what the Soviets did in many cases as well. That gives us a special responsibility to retrieve the situation and to help them on the road back to political stability.
So you want America to intervene and to help food get to starving people in Somalia. What are your concerns as American troops near Somalia?
Well, if the intervention is not accompanied by the facilitation of a national peace conference, a process by which Somalis craft and implement a political solution to their problem, then we will have only stayed disaster. At the end of the intervention, hostilities will re-erupt. There are at least two things that we must try vigorously to accomplish under the aegis of the United Nations, and that is to remove the arms from the country, either through some kind of bounty or confiscation or a combination of both, and to press hard for an international peace conference, a national peace conference under the aegis of the UN, where clan elders, the respected leaders of clans in Somalia, can sit down with these militia leaders and other local leaders to find a way out. If this process does not unfold during the intervention, at the end of the intervention, we'll be right back where we were at the beginning.
Some people are talking about making Somalia a UN trusteeship in a transitional period. Is that something you'd support?
No. I think decisions of this kind are for Somalis to make. The great fear is that the international community will make the mistake of recolonizing Somalia. What has happened in Somalia is hardly Somalia's fault. And I think we have to give Somalis who want peace, Somalis who want stable political structures, who want to resuscitate their economy and the fabric of their society, to do just that. And I think that can be done short of trusteeship. However, if Somalis feel that trusteeship is what is indicated, then that's another matter. That's for Somalis to decide.
My guest is Randall Robinson, Executive Director of Trans Africa, the Black American Lobby for Africa and the Caribbean. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Randall Robinson, who's the head of Trans Africa, which is an African-American lobby for Africa and the Caribbean. Now, it wasn't too long ago that you criticized President Bush for having a double standard, for doing more to help Bosnia than to help Somalia. You accused him of being callous to Somalia and said that this might be a manifestation of racism. What was it you wanted President Bush to do? Is this what you had in mind, sending American troops to intervene?
Well, this might have been avoidable had there been a larger international interest early on in the year. By November, the battle had been lost. This is a situation that has been simmering since Siad Barre fell in January of 1991. Somalia needed help then, and it wasn't given, wasn't noticed by the international community until it was virtually too late. And so we should have been ahead of the curve on this, and we were not, nor was the UN, nor was the Arab League, nor was the Organization for African Unity. So there's plenty of blame to go around here. But I am happy that President Bush took the action that was taken. Not that I relish the thought of an American military intervention. I do not. But nothing is more precious than the salvaging of human life. Nothing stands in front of that.
A lot of people are suggesting that this begins a new foreign policy for the United States, where we use troops for humanitarian reasons. And once we start a kind of policy like that, well, which countries are worthy of sending U.S. troops? How much starvation is enough starvation to require U.S. troops? Have you thought a lot about this and what it means about the future of American foreign policy?
Yes, well, I'm fearful about that. We're all concerned about that, particularly third world countries that fear that the Security Council will be used as an instrument of big power politics. I do at the same time think that Somalia is unique. It's the largest humanitarian disaster in the world. There is little, if any, argument about that. Having said that, we have to make certain that this is not a mere intervention, but a process. necessitates it, that will allow this country to reconstruct itself. And hopefully from the example of that, other African countries, without intervention, will have a chance to survive. I mean, in the early years of the Bush administration, the president requested four times as much in American foreign assistance for tyrannies in Africa as he did for democracies. Africa is a continent being swept by a wave of democracy, democracies to which we haven't paid ample attention, and we still find ourselves funding our Cold War surrogates in Zaire, where Mobutu has stolen virtually most of the aid, contributed, enriched himself, and ruined his country. In Kenya, where much the same is the case, in Sudan, in Liberia, where the country is in wreckage, although we put in the hands of Mr. Doe, a tyrant during the 1980s, over $500 million in American foreign assistance. We've got to make sure now that we turn completely around and provide American support to democratization efforts. If you're not democratizing and you're violating human rights, you shouldn't get a cent in American foreign assistance. And we ought to make that clear to the developing world.
We've all been so moved watching pictures and television images of men and women and children starving in Somalia. At the same time, you know, you walk out of your house in nearly any American city and there's people starving on the sidewalk, living on the sidewalk and starving. What kind of balance do you think we should have now between helping other countries who are starving and helping the people in our own country who are, you know, barely keeping alive?
Well, I certainly think we ought to pay more attention to our cities and to our young people. But I don't think that the two things are mutually exclusive. This intervention in Somalia is a relatively cheap intervention that is not a very risky one, and I don't expect a great deal of resistance. And there again, it distinguishes it from Iraq and Bosnia and other potential flare-ups in the world.
Randall Robinson is the executive director of Trans-Africa. We'll talk about what Somalia represents in the post-Cold War era after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from NPR's reporters in Somalia?
Well, we'll be hearing from Deborah Wong about what's going on in Mogadishu. She's there in the capital city. Also from Daniel Zwerdling, who's with the Marines at the moment, offshore, but we expect them to be landing soon in Somalia. And a talk with anthropologist I.M. Lewis of the London School of Economics about the Somalis and their structure of clans. A Somali child, he says, is taught by his or her mother as a child 20 generations of genealogy on his father's side. And when Somalis would meet historically, they would ask, what is your clan? And recite this background. One's family tree, he says, was one's political manifesto.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Somalia won't be the first place American troops have taken on a humanitarian mission, but this time they may have to use force to carry it out. My guest Michael Clare has written extensively about the American military and low-intensity conflicts around the world. He's the defense correspondent for The Nation. He's also an associate professor of peace studies and world security at Hampshire College in Amherst. I asked him how he would suggest negotiating peace in a country with no government.
I think that this has to be done by people who are familiar with the country, who can go out into the neighborhoods and identify the leaders and find ways of bringing them together. It's a very different kind of diplomacy than we're accustomed to doing, where you go to the head of state and to the foreign minister and talk at that level. This calls for a much more tentative and a lot more patience. It's the kind of work that UN mediators have long been skillful at doing, and very quietly behind the scenes talking to local leaders and trying to bring them together. These kinds of diplomatic skills are mostly unfamiliar to us.
Now, I understand you got a call recently from the Army War College, and they're interested in finding out more about peace studies and conflict resolution.
That's right. I think it's dawning upon people in the military and in the military academies that their role is going to be very different in the post-Cold War era, that it's going to involve a lot more peacekeeping operations, multinational humanitarian rescue, and conflict resolution. These are not skills that they have trained for in the past or are familiar with, and it's natural for them to reach out to people in the conflict resolution and peace studies community who have those skills and can help them.
What do you think Somalia represents in the post-Cold War world?
I think Somalia is a model for the kinds of conflicts and crises we're going to see on a recurring basis. The breakdown of government authority, a lot of internal factional fighting, ethnic wars, in which there'll be no clear division between our side and their side, as we've always had in the Cold War period. We always were able to identify, or at least Washington and Moscow could always identify our side and their side. We're not going to be seeing that very much again. It's going to be much more ambiguous and cloudy, and our interests are going to be in promoting stability and peace and ending the violence. And Somalia represents a test case of that, and we're seeing how difficult and how challenging that's going to be.
What is the connection between the anarchy in Somalia now and the end of the Cold War?
In terms of its origins, we can see that the Cold War period had two impacts on this. On one hand, the Cold War was a system that led to the flooding of the entire Third World with weapons, as the U.S. and the Soviets competed with one another for the loyalty of Third World governments. And Somalia is a very good case because it went back and forth as a client or ally of the Soviet Union and the United States. Each time it changed hands, more weapons were poured into these areas. And those are the weapons that our troops are going to have to face. The end of the Cold War also means the end of superpower control over allies and clients. And we're finding in many of these cases that there were tribal or religious or ethnic animosities that were kept under control or at least suppressed for a time that are now bursting out all over, whether it's in Yugoslavia or the Caucasus region of the Soviet Union or in East Africa.
Do you think that the American troops will run into situations that they haven't faced before or that they're unprepared for?
Yes, I think this is going to be very difficult for our troops. They've been trained to bring the massive amounts of firepower to bear that they have at their disposal and to win quickly through the decisive use of force. That's precisely what we saw in Operation Desert Storm. They're not very well trained or equipped to deal with the minimum use of force, the tentative use of force, to single out that one sniper who's in a community of civilians who are at great risk to firepower. We can't bring in the helicopter gunships and the artillery and blast away at these neighborhoods because we'll kill thousands of innocent civilians. So we're not very well trained at this microscopic use of force. But this is kind of what we're going to have to learn.
Do you support sending U.S. troops to Somalia?
I support sending in a multinational force to Somalia in which the Americans play a role as a logistical backup force, where the work of going into the streets would be done by people of many nations and many races in which the U.S. would only be a part. I don't support the U.S. military acting more or less unilaterally to be the entire force. I think that sets a very bad precedent.
What is our interest in Somalia and in the former Yugoslavia? Is it purely one of compassion, of humanitarian concern, or is there something beyond that that we're talking about too?
Well, I think a humanitarian concern is present here. I certainly think that American leaders are moved by the terrible suffering that's going on. But I think there's also another factor here, and that is redefining America's global role in the post-Cold War era. For the past 45 years, our international role has been defending the West against communist aggression and expansionism. That's who we were. Now we're in the process of taking on what might be a new mission, equally ambitious, and that's protecting the stable, ordered parts of the world against the spreading chaos in other parts of the world. And this could be a lifetime mission for the military, because I think there are many of these potential threats out there. And I think it's a very major change in who we are. I think it needs to be debated by the public and by Congress, because I don't think we know what we're getting into here. But yes, Somalia is very much a new mission for the military, and one that could be replicated many, many times.
What do you think President Bush's intentions were in initiating this action?
Well, of course, I don't know what's going on in his head, but I would suspect it's a combination of humanitarian impulse and a sense that this is his last moment on the great stage of history to leave some famous event. But I think there's also a subliminal sense in which he understands that this is a dry run for the kinds of operations that the military is going to be facing in the years ahead. And he is committed to retaining America's status as the world's number one superpower. And this is what we're going to be doing if we continue to adhere to that mission for ourselves, that image of ourselves, as this kind of police operation. So I think he sees it as a test case, a dry run, to test out the kinds of operations this new police function will entail in the post-Cold War era.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm very glad to be able to do so.
Michael Clare is an associate professor of peace studies and world security at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Be All You Can Be is a popular Army recruiting slogan, but for many women in the military, the slogan translates to Be All They'll Let You Be. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with retired Air Force Major General Jean Holm, author of Women in the Military and Other Finished Revolution. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.